Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a classic big interview. This is where we dig into the vaults and choose an episode from the early days of the show. This time, we've gone all the way back to season 2017-18 and opted for one of our absolute favourites. This is what I had to say about it back then. Do enjoy. Hello, football fans. Welcome to another big interview. This time, it's with the wonderful Terry Gibson. I know Terry well, and I'd consider him a friend. Also, he is, without doubt, one of the best analytical eyes on televised football anywhere in Britain. You listen to him talking about La Liga in his co-commentaries, and you will learn. He's consistently articulate, bright-eyed, and worth listening to. But it wasn't for friendship or analysis that I chose him. Terry had a smashing career, brilliantly talented man. He coped with the ups and downs, and he speaks honestly about how it felt to leave the club that he's always supported. In fact, he's always loved Spurs. Terry is always very, very funny, but there's still frustration in his voice as he recounts a trying time at Manchester United under Ron Atkinson, and then under Sir Alex Ferguson, a manager with whom Terry did have a massive fallout before patching it up and then moving on. But there's a happy ending too, with Wimbledon going on to lift the 1988 FA Cup. Spoiler alert, yeah, they won the final. Terry talks brilliantly about that cup run and the final, the historic final against Liverpool. Terry, you're extremely excited right now. And it's not simply because we're sharing a table again after so long apart at Sky and covering La Liga. You're excited because you're a Spurs man, through and through and through, am I right?
Yes, very much so.
And therefore, times right now look kind of sweet.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird, you know. I've kind of reflected back over my life as a Spurs fan because I grew up as a Spurs fan. My dad was a Spurs fan, my uncles, my cousins. That's who I went to watch Spurs with on a regular basis, and used to carry a milk crate into the ground to stand. All the kids had a milk crate that they could put at the front of the terraces, so everybody passed the kids through. There was always milk crates, so I used to be right near the trainer's bench with the old West Stand, so you could see who was in the trainer's bench,
so you could see over the wall.
Exactly, or, yeah. So
because this is terracing, for those who don't remember terracing,
pay on the day, queue up, went to games where you couldn't get in because it was sold out. Simon was up. I grew up idolising Spurs players. My recollection is watching Chivers, Gilzean, Alan Murray, Phil Beale, people like that.
Cyril Knowles?
Cyril, yep.
Nice one, Cyril.
Yeah, brilliant, yeah. Pat Jennings in goal, of course. So I grew up idolising Spurs and then getting the opportunity to go to Spurs and then getting what I believed at the time discarded by Spurs. For the rest of my football career, probably I've spent the entire length of it trying to prove Spurs wrong, when really there was no need. It was just I was young and fired up, bit of fire in my belly that, you know, I wanted to stay longer. That didn't happen. So for the rest of your career, you sort of fired up against Spurs every time he played them. And then it was kind of nice to go back to being a fan again after all that. You know, when you're playing against the team you support, it kind of you do lose that element of supporting that club. Even when I was, you know, playing for Coventry, that was my first club when I left Spurs. A week later, we were playing at White Hart Lane. I was so fired up, it was ridiculous. And that went on for a long period of my career. So you kind of lose that love, which was sad. Mm-hmm. But you can't have it. If you're a professional and you're playing against them, and you're competing against them, and you know, particularly for one or two of the clubs I played for, which were deemed to be smaller. So like Coventry and Wimbledon, when you go and play White Hart Lane, it's one of the bigger games of the season, and you're the underdog, and you've got to be fired up. So, and Wimbledon and Tottenham had a weird relationship, so it was kind of nice when I stopped playing to then pick up my love of Spurs again.
Where were you in, I suppose it was January 1980?
Yes, it was, yeah.
January 1980, FA Cup third round replay, Old Trafford, 53,762 spectators.
Do we have to describe what a replay is for you younger listeners?
Yeah, so, all right.
Probably. And we used to have more than
one. Does this mean you scored in the 1-1 draw? Was that 1-1
draw?
No,
it was 1-1 on the Saturday, and this would have been midweek. So 3 days later. We didn't have to wait 10 days.
Had you played in the first game?
Yep, my debut was 29th of December against Stoke.
Stoke?
And then
a calm affair.
Yep.
No kicking or fighting or scratching or pulling.
Yeah.
Mike Doyle.
I got a reputation in from day one.
Mm.
And then a part of that was I wanted to play in the next game, and I thought, if I've been picked to play in this one, there was one or two injury issues, but by and large the team weren't scoring, so I was given the go-ahead to have a crack. And I knew we had Manchester United the week later at White Hart Lane in the FA Cup, so that was my first target. Play well against Stoke, we won 1-0, then selected for the next game, which was Manchester United at White Hart Lane, and we drew. So 3 days later we've got the replay at Old Trafford, and picked to play again. It was the dynamic duo, me and Gerry Armstrong up front.
They're
Okay, we'll come
to Gerry in a minute. Yeah. United in them days were Gary Bailey, Martin Buchan, Stuart Houston, Jimmy Nicol, Gordon McQueen, Stevie Coppell, Mickey Thomas, Ray Wilkins, Sammy McElroy, Joe Jordan and Lou McCarry.
Yeah.
You know, a decent 11 there.
Yeah.
A decent 11 there. And the side that Spurs line up is Aleksić, Houghton, Don McAllister, Paul Miller, Steve Perryman, Osvaldo Ardiles, Glenn Hoddle, Ricky Villa, Terry Yorath, Gerry Armstrong and Terry Gibson. And what happens?
You got to remember there's only one sub per team then.
Who's John Pratt.
Yeah, and you would usually use them as an impact or emergency, of course, if injury, emergency. So your reluctant managers were reluctant to use the subs unless you're 1-0 down with 10 minutes to go, and that's where we had the players that become known as super subs. And what happened in this particular game was, I mean, playing at Old Trafford, the Stretford in 60-odd thousand, it probably was. Midweek, it was on sports night, no live, so the highlights were going to be on later on television. And the ball goes into the box and Joe Jordan goes up for a header with Milo Aleksić. Cleans him out, clear elbow. It was even by those standards when centre-forwards were expected to go and challenge goalkeepers in that manner. It was an awful collision. Elbow was out, straight into Melia's jaw as he's mid-air. Fractured his jaw and cheekbone, and it was all over the place in the eye socket. What we didn't realise, though, there was, because he got knocked out in the air, when he landed, his knee spun round.
Yeah, okay.
And he'd done his cruciate knee ligament. So the initial response was to a player that was severely unconscious and his face was a mess. But you're looking at, you're not thinking who's going to go and go, are we going to win this game? You've got a teammate who's in a bad way. And then there was a long time to go in that game as well.
Yeah, I'd say it.
Because we went into extra time as well.
20-something minutes.
So we're thinking, no plan here, who's going to go and go? And Glenn is then, of all players, Glenn's fighting as Mealy is being stretched off. There's not even a replacement goalkeeping jersey. So Glenn's pulling this jersey off of Mealy Aleksić as he's unconscious and could be a neck injury or anything.
I've forgotten.
Give us your shirt and gloves. And Glenn, I'd not seen Glenn in goal before. We somehow managed to.
So did you have big saves to make? Can you remember?
Yes, he did, yeah. He had saves to make, come out for some crosses. which was quite intimidating when Joe Jordan has already done floored one. And then we somehow found our way into extra time. I then had cramp, like debilitating cramp. As I said, I was just over 17 years old, and every time I tried to sprint, I got cramp. But we'd already used the sub, so I've got to stay on. So we're probably Glenn in goal. I'm not able to contribute too much at all. I'm sort of hobbling around, and then Ozzy gets the ball and curls one in the top corner.
Well, for anybody who's
1-0 win,
who's not seen this, what's the pitch like?
The usual, which is brown and
not the usual for now.
No, usual for that time, brown and bobbly and
churned up.
Yeah.
If Ozzy's got space,
yeah,
the ball goes to him immediately. And he kind of just, what? He
wraps his foot around it, curls it, but not without... It's not a powerful...
So sort of it's up and down and curving accurate. Right to left into the far corner.
Yeah.
I don't know, past Gary Bailey, who is a big, tall man, you know, to get it up and down and round, Gary Bailey from there. But on that pitch... With a wall of people in front of him
at that stage of the game, goal, it was late,
sublime technique.
2 hours of football.
I don't know if it wins goal of the season or what it wins or what it doesn't, but it was an iconic goal that kind of
definitely an iconic goal.
You know, there's a reason for everything. So because you know a life story is hard to get into one big interview. Whatever difficulty there was about the leaving of your true love and ending up at Coventry. I want to hone in on... How many hat-tricks did you score in your career?
One. Just the one.
Well, this is the one.
Yeah, I know.
This is the one.
Yeah.
Because, again, if people aren't aware, that you know, England's side at that moment and during your development as a footballer and for a good half of your career, and they're going to crop up later in your story, you know, Liverpool are exceptional. They've got a stranglehold on the title.
Europe.
They consistently win the European Cup. They're pretty damn good in...
Biggest names, best managers, best players. It was...
So how does Coventry beat them 4-0 and what's your role
in that? I don't
know.
Honestly, don't know. Because it was my first game against Liverpool. It was... Most of the team had never played against Liverpool. We had lower league players that had not played against Liverpool. We had Stuart Pearce, who just joined from Wealdstone. Mickey Ginn from Peterborough. Chura Peak from Lincoln. And Dave Bamba came from Blackpool, myself, although I'd played those early games for Spurs, after that it was back to reserve football for a couple of years and then a 20-game spell in the first team in my last year at Spurs. We were really winning games, scoring goals, bit of a surprise package because half of these players no one had known too much about. I think we were about 6th or 7th in the league. We were expected to get relegated because we had Bobby Gould and as a new manager in the top division and all these new unheard of players that went on to have really good careers. And we were 3-0 up in about 20, 25 minutes.
And look, I mean, can we describe what kind of Liverpool we're talking about? Who are we talking about, do you remember?
Well, yes. Phil Neal would have been playing.
Mm-hmm. Because this
Lawrence and Hanson.
This is a year where they're... I mean...
Dalglish and Rush.
How far off lane. This is...
Souness.
Is the brilliant performance. It's not the era of the 5-0 against Nottingham Forest.
This was December 83.
So it's an era when...
No, the era of 5-0 Forest was when we beat them in the cup final.
Beat them in the cup final. So we're talking about them
having... This team was better than that one.
Won the European Cup in 81. Mm-hmm. And got to the final again, I suppose, in... 83. So this is a group of players who have consistently been European Cup finalists or winners.
Yeah.
And so did they not turn up?
Partly. But we blew them away. We were lucky in the fact that Rob Lowe made a couple of mistakes early on as well. And they led to goals. We took every chance that came our way. Backed by a full house at Highfield Road. It was kind of the perfect... They were below par. We were playing well, confident, and played really well. And the idea was to get at them early on to see if they fancied it,
and do you
which
remember
normally
your,
they did.
Do you remember your hat-trick?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. The first one would have been... Dave Bennett, I think, went through and a 1-2, and it never came off, and it bobbled free in the 18-yard box, and I think I slid. That was one of the goals, and I slid in and hooked it. With a bit of a mishit that trundled past.
Top yourself down here.
There was a knockdown in the penalty area from probably Dave Bamba that I turned and swiveled and got a decent strike on. Again, probably Rob Alarm might have been doing better. I think Nicky Plattner had bundled one in over the line as well with a, again, that shot that wasn't really powerful.
And you then, make this sound as if it was like, you know, a combination of luck and... it just stuck out to me as a moment that, you know, I wanted to pick on for you because, you know, that, you know, after having felt ill-treated at Spurs and let go, and you must have thought, like, there's proof that I'm going to make it, that I'm a top footballer.
Yeah, I can't... When I left Spurs, I was annoyed. That hence what I was talking about earlier about my love for... I fell out of love with them because I played 20 games in the first team. When I played those first games as a 17-year-old, I got a four-year contract. When my contract ended, and I didn't play in the first team for over 2 years after those initial three games. And that's Steve Archibald and Garth Crook signed.
Mm.
So I was 17, 18, 19. I'm not going to... And the way that they performed was...
They were scoring goals.
Partnership.
You were winning tournaments.
They were good understanding.
And they were working with... They were a duo, weren't they?
Exactly. They were brilliant.
Yeah.
But in my last year, I got back in and played 20-odd games. And then was offered a one-year contract with a 50 quid a week rise, and that was done through the post.
Mm.
And I just felt that I wasn't being treated accordingly for someone that had played the last 20 games of the first division season that year. To open the post one morning and take it or leave it off of 1 year and 50 quid a week rise.
But the Coventry experiment.
I went to Coventry for 3 years.
It's fantastic.
Less money.
Less money, but playing.
Yes, and
playing.
I felt wanted at Coventry.
Well, you've 50-something goals in a couple of seasons at Coventry.
Yeah.
And United pick you up. And I'm interested about the United... I want you to paint pictures of the two Uniteds you saw.
I had this idea that I was going to leave Coventry because I was, you say, 52 goals in 104 appearances in 2.5 seasons. And the last half of the season, the speculation was I could have nearly came back to Spurs. They sold me for 70,000, didn't want to pay the 250 at one stage that it was to get me back. Peter Shreves had become manager. It was his idea to get me back, so I was keen on that, of course, but that didn't happen. And then the more goals I got, the higher the price went, so the less chance of going back to Spurs. And I kind of knew that United were interested. And then I had a phone call from a former Coventry teammate who was now at Manchester United to ask Brian Atkinson up. Peter Barnes said, Ron wants to know, would you be interested in coming to Man United? Yeah, of course. I, at the time, and I feel it now, it was justified. Me moving to a club, starting my career at Spurs, decent goal scoring record when I was played in the right areas of the pitch, proved myself at Coventry in a relegation threatened team for 2 seasons. We survived on the last day of the season. 19 goals in those 2 seasons, then 14, I think it was, in half a season. Again, in a team that was fighting relegation. 14 goals was harder than any of the players' tallies at Old Trafford when I joined them. It was the season they'd won the first 10 games of the season and looked like they were going to win the league. By the time I joined them in January, it was highly unlikely they were going to win the league. They still had a chance, but it wasn't likely. So I probably joined a team that had peaked that season.
Set the scene. Who's the coach?
Ron Atkinson.
Mm-hmm.
Ron bought me. And I was kind of feel aggrieved that I never got the chance that I should have done. I went there full of confidence. Then with United still having a chance of winning the title for the first time in well over 20 years. And my goal scoring record that season in a team that didn't create as many chances as Man United would was far better than the players that were already at Old Trafford. It was struggling with confidence and stuff like that. I got thrown in against Liverpool for my first game within a week of joining. I say thrown in, away to Liverpool. We drew 1-1 and that was it to the end of the season.
Mm.
Another player, Peter Davenport, was signed. Mark Hughes was still at the club. Frank Stapleton, Mark Hughes left, was going to leave in the summer to go to Barcelona. By the time we got towards the end of the season, and I played at Newcastle with my first game. It was my second game for the club, but 3 months apart, probably longer than the other one. And we were 3-0 up, I think, before I seriously injured my knee with 2 or 3 games to go that season. So it took me a year to make my home debut.
Mm-hmm.
I never played for United at home with Ron as manager. So before I'd settled in, before I'd played a home game for the club, I was on this list of players that were going to be leaving the club without hardly ever getting a game. And I see it time and time again now. So I will stick up for the players that we talk about on our Spanish football. Zaza was one. There's one me at Real Sociedad. I see one me flop at Southampton. Didn't score in 22 appearances. He started two games. So you have to give people a chance. You can't just say...
So put flesh in the bones of what you've talked about. Because
off,
you're talking about a human being's self-regard and confidence and, you know, irrespective of your level of talent, if the mental side, the application, the self-belief, the willingness to take risks, the willingness not to hide, all of these are eroded if you feel that the person who's employed you isn't interested or doesn't want to give you a chance.
And
is that right?
There's always a mystery about it as well. I went and saw Ron on a few occasions and he kind of waffled on. He didn't really give me an honest answer. And then apart from one day he said to me, I signed the wrong player from Coventry. I should have signed Cyril Regis. Yeah, by all means, make a choice. There's no comparison between me as a
difficult
player
mistake to
and
make,
Cyril was a player. It's totally different. And so he was just being flippant. He was trying to be clever. It didn't help. And I was sub one game and I'd been sub for a few matches. And he said, I was actually going to the toilet before the game in the changing room. And he come up and he was going to the toilet. He went, do you know why have you a sub kid? So I said, no. By that time I wasn't really... I could have been clever and said, I'm playing a few different positions, I can quit. So I said, no. He said, because you're a lucky mascot. So I thought, cheers, that's so I'm not going to get on. And if, yeah, it was just weird how everything went so sour so quickly without any obvious reason.
Paint the picture of what the environment was like around you, though, because unfortunately, because you were either rehabbing or waiting for your chance,
you were a pair of eyes,
you were a witness to...
Yeah, the rehabbing was ridiculous when you look back now, but I think it was about three games to go for the end of the season. I had surgery on my knee, I had to have further surgery in the summer, and then I was expected to return back pre-season on my own accord, fit enough to train again. And I did. There was no physio, there was no rehabilitation at the club. It was...
Just get on with it.
Yeah, come back and see if you're fit for day one of pre-season. And then I went back pre-season and the same thing continued. I got a game at Leicester. We were in the relegation position just before Ron got the sack.
Manchester United, wasn't
yes, and we hadn't won. I got another game at Leicester. So now my first three games have probably come about 6 or 7 months apart. They've all been away from home. And then we got a draw at Leicester. First points for a few games, or first point of the season or something. Something really weird like that. And then I was dropped again the following week. And we had Southampton at home. And they won 5-0. We won 5-0.
But
it was always going to be an easier game than the one the week before, the ones the week before that, where the confidence was going away. We get a good draw at Leicester, and then I'm thinking, I might get a game against Southampton, who were another team that were probably struggling at the time below us or something. And it 5-0, and I was back on the bench.
What was the regime like? Because what's emerged now is that the new regime, which we'll talk about in a minute, came in and found slackness and decay and players who were drinking or players who were kind of allowed to do what they wanted to do. The Ron Atkinson, he strikes me as somebody who had his mind on greater things or on himself or whatever, but it wasn't the right regime at a big football club?
Yeah, no.
Or is that unfair?
No, it's not. It's, as I said, I think that team peaked that season. It was only when I went to Manchester United and people could drift out and train when they wanted to. The manager could drift out and train when he wanted to. For instance, a perfect example would be travel down to London for a game with Coventry or travel up north with Spurs and stay in a hotel overnight. There would be a set dinner time at 6 o'clock. There would be a menu that you could choose from. It would be super melon, chicken or steak. It was the same for both teams. When I went to United, my first trip down to London, we stayed in the Royal Lancaster Hotel. I'm sharing a room with Mickey Duxbury. And I've said to him, what time's dinner? He went, well, what do you mean, what time's dinner? I said, well, don't... He went, no, just... There's four or five different restaurants here or we can order room service. So, oh, strange. So we ended up, as you were, totally abused. We had a big strawberry gâteau and a big strawberry milkshake and steak and Dover sole and lobster, and it was just with normally.
No, I remember team unity, no structure.
We get to the hotel in London about 4 o'clock, and we're leaving at midday, 1 o'clock the next day. We don't see each other. until that time. So you've had dinner, breakfast, everything's room service. The big trays coming into your room on the trolley with a big silver platter thing on top with your lobster and prawns under it. And then at the end of it, Mickey Duxbury empties the entire minibar into his bag. And Mickey's not even a drinker. And I said, what are you doing? He went, oh, this is for the lads, the drinkers, on the way home on the bus. Clearly it was different because it wasn't like it at Spurs. It wasn't like it at Coventry. Yeah. It was just like it. Now, whether it had always been like that on the run, I doubt it. I probably don't think it had because he'd had success with a group of players that had grown with him, like Norman Whiteside and Paul McGrath, and probably the whole thing became a little bit too comfortable in terms of team selection, people fighting for a place. They didn't have to. There was a group that were runs... friends as much as anything else. So it was different. There was no organisation, there was no planning for the next game, there was no team shape, there was no tactics. It was just the same players knew that they were planning it, you know, unless...
Because that wasn't affection, you know, because you smiled for the first time because you were not...
Oh, no, as a player, you loved it. It was all you wanted to do. There's the three things you wanted to do. Shooting practice, a bit of a keep ball session or a small-sided game and some sprints. But it was not conducive to... organisation,
no learning from the last mistakes of the last game or what. So the new broom. Look, you're going to last, you know, to the end of a season with Sir Alex Ferguson, Fergie. Then, yeah. But one, who the hell was he when he was? I know, I grew up in Aberdeen.
Yeah,
he was everything to me and people.
You know,
like
I knew who he was, and I, at the time, yeah, he wasn't a massive name. It wasn't a surprise. He'd been linked for the job. The speculation that Rob was on borrowed time. So he was the name that kept coming up, with knowing about his success at Aberdeen. And any manager that walks in through the door, the first thing a player wants to do is a first impression and impress and hope he fancies you.
What did you notice? Someone. What did you notice?
Straight away. There was an instant.
Tell me the thing.
Our first away trip was... funny enough, place where I ended up living, where I'd lived before, in Epping, little post house hotel. We were playing West Ham. It was the sensible place to stay. It was near to Upton Park. It's not a great hotel. It's still not a great hotel. But Manchester United stayed there because it was convenient. And the first night, the away trip was super melon, chicken and steak. It was, and there was a meeting time for dinner. Yeah. There was a meeting time.
And you ate together?
And a meeting for the next day. Yeah, we ate together. And everything was back to normal again. There was
mini
no
bar.
No, they were empty.
Training ground, what did you notice?
Well, the treatment room overlooked the pitch as well. So for 3 days of the week, half the first thing would be watching training through the window.
Mm.
And then turn up on Thursday and Friday and play Saturday. So that changed. That treatment room cleared out because of a new manager. So everybody was miraculously recovered and fit and rearing to go. And then... instead of ambling around waiting for the manager to come out or players to come out and train, it was from day one he read the rule book.
What were the rules?
All the same rules that were Spurs and Coventry.
Ah.
So it was just normal
timekeeping
procedure. Yeah, exactly. The basic requirements that were expected, I thought were expected everywhere and probably were.
It ends up not working for you to the extent that you're, you know... you're about to quit football, you know, a big fall.
Yeah, I gave up with the whole Manchester United thing. With Fergie, he gave me far more respect. He didn't buy it. He wasn't the manager that bought me, but he gave me opportunities. And when I say I gave up, that's probably the wrong phrase. I'd lost faith in the project. I pretty soon after Sir Alex Ferguson took over, I was constantly on this list of players that he wanted out. And that was a reflection on him. It was just made up list from that carried on from when Ron was manager, that the whole speculation always at United was who they were going to buy, who they were going to sell.
Mm.
And it was kind of... It destroyed your self-esteem to continue to see your name on the list with, you know, 10, 12, a lot of players, but the same names on it all the time. And I kind of made up my mind that at the end of the season, it wasn't for me, even though I had more playing opportunities and scored a goal against Arsenal... Old Trafford. So it kind of, but I have no complaints with how Sir Alex Ferguson treated me in his time, but it was a lost cause. I was a lost cause. The whole Manchester United thing for me was a lost cause, and I needed to get away. We fell out big time at the end.
You lost it completely
for 24 hours. We had a game at Chesterfield in, for the reserves pre-season. I'd already sold my house. I was living in a hotel. I'd made up my mind I was leaving. I wanted to go, same as we talked about earlier, and play regular again. And we had a reserve game at Chesterfield, so my mind's all over the place. Wife and daughter have moved back down to London, waiting for me to get a move somewhere, and this game at Chesterfield, we actually got, it was a, playing their first team. So it's Chesterfield first team, it's Manchester United reserves, young team. I think me and John Severbeck were the only two sort of senior players. Mm-hmm. And we got there late, stuck in traffic, literally 10, 15 minutes before kickoff. It's a full house at Saltergate, their stadium. 12, 15,000 people because it's
rocking, ready to turn
and
over United.
We were, I can't remember exactly, it was a 5-4 or a 4-3. But whatever it was, we were losing 3-0 or 4-0 after about half an hour.
And what overturned it?
And came back and won.
Not bad.
So at half-time, we've had this horrendous journey. We got there late, straight onto the pitch, young team, first team opposition, men, senior players. And we came back, second half, warmed up. We'd warmed up from the journey, got our legs going and ended up winning. And Fergie was there. And I thought it would have been something that he would have really have liked. The difficulty, the journey.
Glorious Fergie Man United fight back.
And he came in and he went berserk. And he said, I want to see you all in my office first thing in the morning. And we went in and he read the right act again and said how what a disgrace we were to the club, the history. He really let rip. And I, as John Severbeck, was similar, exactly the same
Danish
as
fullback.
Yeah, Danish international, he was a terrific player as well. We signed the same day and left us pretty much the same day, and we were treated exactly the same way. It was a weird situation. And John didn't say anything. And I stood up and said my point and said that I thought we deserved, the younger players deserved credit, that, you know, explained how we got there late, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went out to hammer and tongs, and I told him he could shove his football up his arse and stormed out, slammed the door in front of all the other players and said that was it. I was jacking it in. I go back to the hotel, ring Paula, my wife, tell her what's happened. She said, oh, Bobby Gould's rang you. So I said, oh, what did he want? And he'd just take the Wimbledon job. So I'm thinking, what did he want? I'm thinking, please. Back in London, a bloke that likes me, yeah, who bought me at Coventry, treated me well, got me playing well, had faith. So I said, what does he want? She said, I don't know. He's left a number. So I rang him and he said, do you fancy it? I said, oh,
what?
Yes, I do. Yeah, of course I do. So I said, I was even going to ring you for advice because my head's coming off. I don't know what I'm doing. So he said, look, we can't pay you for a bit of negotiation. When he said, do you fancy it? I said, well, make me an offer.
I'm not United,
even.
Bob, yeah. Wimbledon, come on.
And we spoke, and he said, how much do you think he wants? So I said,
Fergie.
I said, I've no idea, don't know. So he said, all right, leave it with me. So I went in, and I was going to do this anyway. It wasn't because there was a chance that Wimbledon were going to buy me. I slept on it, and I went in the next morning, and I said, I got in there early. And, of course, he was there. And he said, would you want? So I said, I'm coming to apologise. I was out of order. But I still stand by what I say. And I'm not going to pack in football. So he said, oh, why that? I said, because I want to come and score against you and I want to win a trophy. And I said, and so lo and behold, the next year I'd score two goals and knocked him out of the League Cup, won the FA Cup. And then he went to me and said, OK, Bobby Gould rang you? So I went, no. I was lying through my teeth. He knew. And he went, swear on your daughter's life. And I went, I can't do that. He went, tell him I want 200 grand. And I literally used the payphone in the training ground.
Brilliant.
To ring Bobby Gould to tell him 200 grand. And then I hung around pretending I didn't know that there might be an offer going in. And then Fergie came out. It was Terry Gibson telling me Bobby Gould's been on the phone.
What a day. What a day for you.
Boots in the car. When I joined Wimbledon, Bob didn't take me to Plough Lane or the training ground because he didn't want me to see them.
He thought it would put you off.
So he met me in a pub in Wimbledon Village, which was really nice. And then I agreed and then went to Plough Lane and there's a porter cabin. And then there's the training ground, which was a transport cafe for lorry drivers and school playing fields.
Unless anybody forget, we're talking about Wimbledon in the division that is now the Premier League. This is a Wimbledon Premier League.
Top seven, top eight, regular.
And yet these were your facilities.
Incredible. Yeah. Buy your own boots, make your own way to games, drive your own car to FA Cup semi-final.
How did you actually win the cup? Because I'm trying to pinpoint, everybody knows, listen to this, that you're Terry Gibson FA Cup winner. Mm-hmm. Even though they know you're an FA Cup winner, they don't know the ludicrous personal situation that you were in to be able to turn out at Wembley on that blazing hot day against Liverpool. And I think it's worth explaining, because I think it's people don't know the struggles that players have, or the risks they take, or sometimes what they're willing to do to achieve their personal moment of glory. And in this instance, this interview, that applies to you.
Do you know, I fractured my pelvis when I was 14 and played within 6 weeks because we had a cup final. There's nothing there. I had this Oscar Slatter's disease when I was at Spurs and took no time off at all. So you kind of become accustomed to, if I can, I will, which has massively changed now. Whereas, you know, they're finely tuned, too finely tuned. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing, growing up, seeing older players having injections in their knees and their feet. Mm-hmm. I had injections in my groins, in my ribs, and ankles, and because it was... It was expected of you to do it, and also you didn't want to miss a game. You wanted to play. So that season that we're talking about, the FA Cup, I actually had a hernia. So I missed the first two rounds. I had what is known as a Gilmore's groin. I was one of the first to have it.
Well done.
I was having this continuous pain in my groin and hip and lower back that no one had ever really identified what it was. And it was a kind of hernia. And he would stick his finger in through the skin and find the tear, and you'd hit the roof with pain, and he would do something. It was Otis Gilmore is his name, and he became famous for carrying out all these surgeries that players in the past had suffered, and there was no real sort of cure for it. So I was lucky that there was someone around that knew what the problem was. So you would go residential at Lillishall, who had the staff there and the facilities there, because clubs weren't interested in you if you were out for 6 months, because there was one physio that looked after all the players at the club, did all the strappings, all the treatments, so you would be neglected. So you would go together to Lillishall and train there, and a group of like-minded people, the injured, find their way back. I remember doing a circuit there after my hernia, and I felt the other side tear. I literally heard it tear. Yeah. So I thought, oh, no. So I came back and spoke to the club, and they said, no, it can't have happened. Started training, still feeling the pain, and then we came to an arrangement that I would play whilst we were still in the FA Cup. So I wouldn't train, I would play, and then recover. I would have to drive into Wimbledon and have a bath, in an old tin bath. I got one at home, but it was a real thing in back in the day that coming for a bath, sometimes you drive 2 hours to go and have a bath when you got one at home. Anyway, so there was no physio, I wasn't training, I couldn't jog. Towards the end of the week, I could jog in straight lines, but I couldn't sprint round corners or go fast round corners. I wore these ridiculous neoprene thick shorts under my match shorts when I was playing.
Kind of like a groin corset or a hernia corset.
Exactly what it was.
To hold it in.
Yeah. And then we got through one round, and then the next round, and the next round. And so I'd probably done that early March, I'd probably say, from March till May. I barely trained, because if I trained, it would hurt for 2 or 3 days. So I would play, then hurt for 2 or 3 days, and recover, and then play again in the next game. So, and what made it worse, I actually picked up a medial knee ligament injury as well. So if you look in the semi-final, I've got strapping around my knee, and that's to hold the joint together. And then 6 days before the final, I'm pretty sure I broke my, what is now known as metatarsal, but it used to be just the bone in the top of your foot that I kicked through the bottom of Paul McGrath's boot.
You're playing Man United,
at Old Trafford,
aren't you?
6 days before the final. I'd scored, had another shot, Paul's blocked the shot, and I've hit the bottom of his boot. I can't get my boot on 24 hours before the cup final because it's swollen. So I slept, when I did get it on, with my boot on.
In a situation like that,
put shoes on.
When you can't get your shoes on, your foot's really swollen. Yeah. One of the things you should never do is go to the pub. So luckily you didn't.
No. What? I didn't drink, though.
What? But you did go to the pub.
We trained
the night before the FA Cup final, right?
And also, we trained for 3 hours that night before the cup final. So when people say, what makes the spirit? It wasn't hard. It wasn't intense. It wasn't physical. We trained
3 hours.
For 3 hours on set pieces. Defending set pieces, attacking set pieces. the amount of detail that went in and the amount of hard work that went in, the amount of fitness training that went in. But the attention to detail, the hard work, the preparation, the professionalism, I've been nowhere better than at Wimbledon. I quite liked that we were winning games of football, not getting beat, and ultimately winning a trophy. So people ask me, "What? How did that work out?" They all think we're a bunch of Herberts that had a laugh and a joke and found their way into an FA Cup final. It was arguably the most professional group of players that I've worked with the right manager and the right coach.
You substitute and everything you've said, and it's Atletico Madrid.
Yeah, exactly.
At its very best.
We believe at Wimbledon we invented the channel ball, the in-swinging free kick. Before we did it, no one did an in-swinging free kick. It ends up winning us the FA Cup final. The diving header, we invented that. the goalkeeper dribbling out, near enough, as far as they'd let him.
To gain some territory so that the ball goes...
He was best was pinging it in the 18-yard box from 15 yards. So all the things that are detrimental to football in general, well, if I was an outsider, I'd be looking at it and thinking, why do you claim credit for that? But it was literally something different, something that came from Dave Bassett that was moved on, that Don Howe and Bobby Gould progressed with, to being so organised. The fittest players I've ever played with were the boys at Wimbledon. We were programmed, fit, great attitude, never say die. When we came together over that white line before kick-off, we were together. Whatever happened off the field, Monday to Friday or Saturday night, didn't matter.
Yeah.
But against the odds, we were going to win games of football and ultimately win a trophy.
When your mate gets the goal, which is a nice part of the story.
But and he shouldn't have been there. After all that 3 hours training, Corky should have been there, not Sanch. Corky messed up. Corky still is bitter about it now. Alan Cork.
I know what you mean. Yeah. Jack's.
Yeah, Jack's dead, yeah. Corky was meant to be where Sanch was. I can remember it. I was edge of the box, and I remember Sanch saying, Corky, go there.
You're now out of my comfort. You don't have to explain it.
We had the in-swinging free kick.
Yeah.
And as I say, we trained for 3 hours, and Corky still got it wrong. I don't know whether he thought he would use his experience, because he was a clever player, Corky, and try something different. And Sanch was shouting. I remember Sanch shouting and Corky go, like, near. Go exactly position... I'm trying to describe it, where Laurie scored from.
Mm.
That was meant to be Corky, and Sanch was meant to be somewhere else. Sanch saw that Corky wasn't there and thought...
Filled the space.
I'm going to go, yeah, and then...
And gets the goal.
So Corky still says, should have been me. And it should have been him. And he would have done exactly the same, because that was his speciality, wasn't it, Corky? The glancing header.
There's a price for being a free spirit, Corky. There is a price for being a free spirit.
So that should have been Corky.
What an absolute joy, my friend. A privilege.
My pleasure.
What a fabulous football career. What a right good football mind you've got.
Talk for England now.
Begin of you fans, share some love with Terry Gibson.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.